America, 1915 to 1970. A series of unpredictable events and frustrations led to the decisions of Ida Mae Gladney, George Swanson Starling, and Robert Pershing Foster to leave the South for good. Their decisions were separate and distinct from anything in the outside world, except that they were joining a road already plied decades before by people as discontented as themselves. 1,000 hurts and killed wishes led to a final determination by each fed-up individual on the verge of departure, which, added to millions of others, made up what could be called a migration. If there was a single precipitating event that set off the Great Migration, it was World War I. After all, blacks had tried to escape the South with limited degrees of success from the time the first slaves arrived in Virginia in 1619. The Underground Railroad spirited hundreds of slaves out of the South and as far north as Canada before the Civil War. Later in 1879, Benjamin Papp Singleton, a former slave who made coffins for colored lynching victims and was disheartened by the steadiness of his work, led a pilgrimage of 6,000 ex-slaves known as Exodusters from the banks of the Mississippi River onto the free soil of Kansas. In the ensuing decades, a continuous trickle of brave souls chanced an unguaranteed existence in the unknown cities of the North. The trickle became a stream after Jim Crow laws closed in on blacks in the South in the 1890s. During the first decade of the 20th century, some 194,000 blacks left the coastal and border states of the South and settled in relative anonymity in the colored quarters of primarily northeastern cities, such as Harlem in New York and in North Philadelphia. Some were domestics for wealthy northerners. Others were musicians, intellectuals, and exiled politicians of the Reconstruction era, who would inspire colored people in the South by their very existence. But the masses did not pour out of the South until they had something to go to. They got their chance when the North began courting them, hard and in secret, in the face of Southern hostility during the labor crisis of World War I. Word had spread like wildfire that the North was finally opening up. The war had cut the supply of European workers the North had relied on to kill its hogs and stoke its foundries. Immigration plunged by more than 90%, from 1,218,480 in 1914 to 110,618 in 1918, when the country needed all the labor it could get for war production. So the North turned its gaze to the poorest paid labor in the emerging market of the American South. Steel mills, railroads, and packing houses sent labor scouts disguised as insurance men and salesmen to recruit blacks north, if only temporarily. The recruiters would stride through groupings of colored people and whisper without stopping, "Anybody want to go to Chicago? See me." It was an invitation that tapped into pent-up yearnings and was just what the masses had been waiting for. The trickle that became a stream had now become a river, uncontrolled and uncontrollable, and about to climb out of its banks. Some 555,000 colored people left the South during the decade of the First World War, more than all the colored people who had left in the 5 decades after the Emancipation Proclamation, which promised the freedoms they were now forced to pursue on their own. At first, the South was proud and ambivalent, pretended that it did not care. "As the North grows blacker, the South grows whiter," the New Orleans Times-Picayune happily noted. Then, as planters awoke to empty fields, the South began to panic. "Where shall we get labor to take their places?" asked the Montgomery Advertiser, as Southerners began to confront the reality observed by the Columbia State of South Carolina. "Black labor is the best labor the South can get. No other would work long under the same conditions. It is the life of the South, a Georgia plantation owner once said. It is the foundation of its prosperity. God pity the day when the Negro leaves the South. With all our crimes of omission and commission, we still retain a marked affection for the Negro, wrote David L. Cohn in the 1935 book God Shakes Creation. It is inconceivable to us that we should be without him. The Macon Telegraph put it more bluntly. We must have the Negro in the South, it said. It is the most pressing thing before this state today. Matters of governorships and judgeships are only bagatelle compared to the real importance of this Negro exodus. Yet as reality sank in, nobody could agree on what to do about it, debating to the point of exasperation. Why hunt for the cause when it's plain as the noonday sun? Wrote a white reader in the Montgomery Advertiser. He doesn't want to leave, but he knows if he stays here, he will starve. They have nothing to eat, no clothes, no shoes, and they can't get any work to do, and they are leaving just as fast as they can get away. If the Negro race could get work at 50 cents a day, he would stay here. And a newspaper in Columbia, South Carolina, put this question to the ruling caste. If you thought you might be lynched by mistake, the paper asked, would you remain in South Carolina? When the South woke up to the loss of its once guaranteed workforce, it tried to find ways to intercept it. Southern authorities resurrected the anti-enticement laws originally enacted after the Civil War to keep newly freed slaves from being lured away, this time, however, aimed at northern companies coveting the South's cheapest and most desperate workers. Conditions recently became so alarming, that is, so many Negroes were leaving, wrote an Alabama official, that the state began making anyone caught enticing blacks away, labor agents they were called, pay an annual license fee of $750. In every county in which he operates or solicits immigrants, or be fined as much as $500 and sentenced to a year's hard labor. Macon, Georgia, required labor agents to pay a $25,000 fee and to secure the unlikely recommendations of 25 local businessmen, 10 ministers, and 10 manufacturers in order to solicit colored workers to go north. But by the middle of World War I, those laws were useless. Northern industries didn't need to recruit anymore. Word had spread, and the exodus took on a life of its own. Every Negro that makes good in the North and writes back to his friends starts off a new group, a Labor Department study observed. So the South tried to choke off the flow of information about the North. The chief of police in Meridian, Mississippi, ordered copies of the Chicago Defender confiscated before they could be sold, fearing it was putting ideas into colored people's heads. When the people kept leaving, the South resorted to coercion and interception worthy of the Soviet Union, which was forming at the same time across the Atlantic. Those trying to leave were rendered fugitives by definition, and could not be certain they would be able to make it out. In Brookhaven, Mississippi, authorities stopped a train with 50 colored migrants on it and sidetracked it for 3 days. In Albany, Georgia, the police tore up the tickets of colored passengers as they stood waiting to board, dashing their hopes of escape. A minister in South Carolina, having seen his parishioners off, was arrested at the station on the charge of helping colored people get out. In Savannah, Georgia, the police arrested every colored person at the station, regardless of where he or she was going. In Summit, Mississippi, authorities simply closed the ticket office and did not let northbound trains stop for the colored people waiting to get on. Instead of stemming the tide, the blockades and arrests served to intensify the desire to leave, wrote the sociologists Willis T. Weatherford and Charles S. Johnson, and to provide further reasons for going. To circumvent the heavy surveillance, some migrants simply bought tickets to cities two or three stations away where they would not be recognized or where there was less of a police presence. There, under less scrutiny, they bought tickets to their true destination. Those who had somehow gotten on the wrong side of somebody in the ruling class had to go to unusual lengths to get out. One man disguising himself as a woman to flee Crystal Springs, Mississippi, for Chicago in the 1940s. Chastened by their losses, some businessmen tried conciliation. One delegation going so far as to travel to Chicago to persuade former sharecroppers that things had changed and it was time they came back. The sharecroppers showed no interest and instead took the opportunity to complain about being cheated and whipped while in their employ. In the 1920s, the Tennessee Association of Commerce, the Department of Immigration of Louisiana, the Mississippi Welfare League, and the Southern Alluvial Land Association all sent representatives north to try to bring colored workers back. They offered free train tickets and promised better wages and living conditions. They returned empty-handed. When these efforts didn't work, some planters increased wages, if only temporarily, and tried easing up on their workers to induce them to stay. Owing to the scarcity of labor, the Labor Department reported, a Georgia farmer near Albany this year laid aside his whip and gun, with which it is reported he has been accustomed to drive his hands, and begged for laborers. Oblivious to the hand-wringing, trainloads of colored people took their chances and crowded railroad platforms. Men hopped freight trains and hoboed out of the South in grain bins. Women walked off cotton fields in Texas, hiding their Sunday dresses under their field rags, bound for California. A granite quarry in Lithonia, Georgia, had to shut down because its workers had vanished. One section gang left their tools on the spot, not stopping to get their pay, on a bon ton road of one work site. All the while, in the places they left, the weeds grew up over the cotton, the rice and tobacco lay fallow and unpicked, and the mules wandered the pastures, because as the historian James R. Grossman noted, there was no one to hitch them to a plow. Breaking away. I was leaving without a qualm, without a single backward glance. The face of the South that I had known was hostile and forbidding, and yet out of all the conflicts and the curses, the tension and the terror, I had somehow gotten the idea that life could be different. I was now running more away from something than toward something. My mood was, I've got to get away. I can't stay here. Richard Wright, Black Boy. Chickasaw County, Mississippi, October 1937. Ida Mae Brandon Gladney. In a day, the world had changed. Everything was in a commotion, but George and Ida Mae could not let it show. Joe Lee had been beaten half dead over a false accusation about some turkeys that had run off. He had been left in a jail cell, barely conscious, his clothes sticking to his bloodied skin, and nothing was done about it. Ida Mae and George bent their heads and prayed for light. Then they went out in the field the next day. They picked long and hard and more urgently than before. They decided they would leave as soon as they got the cotton out of the ground. They would give Mr. Ed no cause to suspect their intentions or to withhold their pay. They needed whatever was due at settlement to get out of Mississippi. They could not risk telling anyone but Saint and Miss Theney and the one or two other relatives they needed to help them get out. And so they continued to gather the cotton. The land went from white to brown as they made their way across it. They began selling off their possessions one by one so as not to attract attention. The cows, the hogs, the chickens, the feather beds and quilts, the tin tub, the washpots, the rusted old Model T Ford, the double-blade axes Ida May used to chop wood and kill snakes with. They went into town and sold what livestock was theirs and not Mr. Ed's. What they didn't sell, they gave away or left with Saint to dispense with. And if anybody asked what was going on, they knew to say, "We just running out of room." For some reason, Ida May was dragging more than usual. But there was so much to do and so little time, there was no point in mentioning it. They needed to get out before people started speculating about what it was they were doing. The way people talked, it wouldn't take long to get back to Mr. Ed. Someone would love to curry favor, alert him to a sharecropper trying to leave. There were spies and toms all over the place, setting up fellow colored men and sending them to their deaths for an extra privilege or two. Planters did not like to lose good help. They had ways of keeping sharecroppers under them, claimed they owed money when they didn't, that they had to work off the debt, which meant that they were working for free, and made fugitives of them if they left. The planters kept the books, and even if a sharecropper had the nerve to keep his own, a colored man's numbers didn't count. If George and Ida May didn't get out, life could be harder than it already was. The quicker they got the cotton out of the ground, the better off they would be. It was already late in the season, and before long they had picked their last bale. George had to figure out how best to leave. He decided first to get off Mr. Ed's land. They quietly gathered up what little they were taking and carried it over to Miss Theeny's after the cotton was picked. They would leave from the house where George had courted Ida May. George wanted to settle with Mr. Ed as soon as possible and prepared to go see him. After what happened to Jolie, Ida May worried whenever George went out. "George, be careful," she said. "I ain't gonna be careful. I ain't done nothing to him." George went up to Mr. Ed like it was any other end-of-the-season settlement. He gave no indication that it was his fervent hope never to see him again in life or ever again to set foot in the state of Mississippi. He looked over the list of credits and debits Mr. Ed had tallied, the bales of cotton he and Ida May had gathered, the seed and cornmeal they had consumed. It didn't matter what he thought of it. He couldn't dispute it no matter what it said. At the bottom of the page was a figure that showed he had a few dollars coming to him for a year's worth of labor. It was not much, but it was more than many sharecroppers got. Fewer than one out of five sharecroppers ever saw a profit at the end of the year. Of the few who got anything, their pay came to between $30 and $150 in the 1930s for a year of hard toil in the field, according to a leading Yale anthropologist of the era, or between 9 and 48 cents a day. The remaining 80% either broke even, meaning they got nothing, or stayed in debt, which meant they were as bound to the planter as a slave was to his master. There was no place to appeal. How a man treats his tenants is not felt to be a matter of public concern, the anthropologist Hortense Powdermaker wrote, but is as much his private affair as what brand of toothpaste he uses. George did the math in his head and saw that, along with what he had managed to save up to this day, it was enough for 4 tickets north on the Illinois Central Railroad. Mr. Ed handed him the bills, and George completed the transaction without so much as a smile, which was his way. He tucked the money in his pocket and thought about what next to say. There before him stood his boss man and overseer of close to 10 years. Mr. Ed was a man a full head taller than George, and partial to 10-gallon hats. Whatever he may have done to other colored people in the name of the white man's law, Mr. Ed had been honorable in his dealings with him. He had never raised a hand to him or Ida May, and George gave him no cause to do so. George could have left after settlement without saying a word. It was a risk to say too much. The planter could rescind the settlement, say he misfigured, turn a credit into a debit, take back the money, evict the family, or whip the sharecropper on the spot, or worse. Some sharecroppers, knowing they might not get paid anyway, fled from the field, right in mid-hoe, on the first thing going north. The planters could not conceive of why their sharecroppers would want to leave. The dance of the compliant sharecropper conceding to the big planter year in and year out made it seem as if the ritual actually made sense, that the sharecropper, having been given no choice, actually saw the tilted scales as fair. The sharecropper's forced silence was part of the collusion that fed the mythology. And so it came as a shock to many planters when their trusted sharecroppers expressed a desire to leave. Like one planter in Florence, Alabama. Year after year, he would go down the list of staples he said his sharecropper Jack Fowler owed. 1 pound flour, 1 pound rice, 1 pound cornmeal, 1 pound coffee. The planter scanned the page and decided to add a few more pounds of coffee, increasing Fowler's debt to him. One year, the sharecropper finally spoke up, careful not to suggest the planter was a liar or an outright cheat. "Mr. Perry, you know I don't drink coffee." With that, the planter added another pound of coffee to the list. The sharecropper could do nothing but watch. One year, the planter's son happened to come in during settlement and spoke up himself. "Pa, you know Jack don't drink coffee." And for once, the sharecropper didn't have to pay for something he had never consumed in the first place. Sometime after settlement, he went to tell his boss man he was leaving for a place called Lake Forest, Illinois. The planter had already settled with Jack Fowler and had no rational excuse to keep the sharecropper on his plantation, which didn't mean he couldn't have if he wanted to. Instead, the planter tried to scare the sharecropper out of leaving. "Jack, you gonna go up there and freeze your brains," the planter told his sharecropper. "And who is going to handle my horses when you leave?" Knowing the dangerous and arbitrary rules of the world he was in, George stood before Mr. Ed and weighed what he should say. Mr. Ed had already paid him, so George thought he was safe. They had agreed that George did not owe him and was not in the planter's debt. Mr. Ed had always been a man of his word, and George trusted him to keep it now. George made the calculation that the truth would serve him better than if he were later caught in a knowing omission. He prayed and breathed deep before speaking.
"Well, this'll be my last crop with you, Mr. Ed," George said.
He told him he and Ida May were moving to Milwaukee. Mr. Ed did not see it coming.
"Oh, you ain't gonna leave, George," Mr. Ed said.
George was a quiet man who could pick a whole field by himself without complaint. He took whatever was given him and knew not to question. Yet he had a way of walling off his family that even a segregationist could respect. George was the kind of sharecropper a planter could depend on, and Mr. Ed showed his appreciation by letting him clear a few dollars most years. Mr. Ed didn't want to lose George. He wanted to know what he was leaving for. George told him he didn't like what happened to Joe Lee.
"Oh, you ain't gonna leave for that," Mr. Ed said. "It wasn't none of you."
"I know," George said. "It wouldn't have been me."
Ida May was gathering their belongings while George settled with Mr. Ed. She lumbered as she went about her packing. Miss Thiney looked at her hard. She saw something that nobody else would notice. How Ida May loped now, the way the burlap tugged across the front of her.
"Look to me like you pregnant," she said.
"Oh, no, I ain't."
"What you going up there for, pregnant?" "I ain't pregnant."
She was a couple of months along now and had kept it to herself. George might tell her to stay in Mississippi, leave her and the children with Miss Theney, say he would send for her like the other men who say they're going to send for their wives and don't, get up to the big city and forget all about what they left. If Miss Theney knew, she would kick up a fuss and scare George into leaving Ida Mae there. So she lied to Miss Theney, denied up and down that she was expecting, and Miss Theney couldn't prove it, but knew that time would tell and prove her right. There was no way for Ida Mae to know what was transpiring between her husband and Mr. Ed at settlement. George had prayed over it, and had hoped Mr. Ed would remain a man of his word. If all went well, George told Ida Mae, he would go to the train station in Okolona ahead of them. He wanted to get the tickets right away. He had arranged in advance for one of his brothers to take Ida Mae and the children to the station to meet him. The plan was for them to leave that night. Eustis, Florida, April 1945. George Swanson Starling. Little George broke the news to Inez that he was getting out of Eustis on the next train out of Wildwood. The Grove owners had it in for him because he had roused up the Pickers. The Pickers had turned on him out of fear for themselves. He had no choice but to get out. He told Inez he was going up to Harlem, where his aunts were. He started gathering his things right away. There was no time to waste. The yard boy who warned him about the Grove owners' meeting didn't seem to know any more than what he'd happened to overhear, that the Grove owners were plotting to take George and Mud and Sam out to the cypress swamps over at Blackwater Creek and hang them at a necktie party, that the owners were bent on teaching them a lesson for stepping out of their place, demanding an extra dime for the fruit they picked, and turning the heads of the faithful other pickers who had been content with whatever the owners gave them. There was no telling whom the Grove owners might have enlisted, when or how they might round the boys up, whether it would be the new big hat sheriff, some crew foreman or clansman currying favor, whether it might be somebody George would recognize right away after all these years, or not know at all. He went about his last-minute arrangements, watchful of everybody, and careful to mind his steps. He could not be seen anywhere near the Groves again. It was dangerous enough just being in Eustis during the hours it took to get out. There were so many things he wanted or needed to do. He was leaving forever, after all. But he was running out of time. He dashed off a letter to his aunts, Annie and Lovata, to alert them to his situation. They would need to know to expect him. He tried to reassure Inez that everything would work out, but she was still seething over the fact that he had turned their lives upside down and put all of them in danger. She hadn't approved of what he'd been doing anyway, and didn't know why he couldn't make himself satisfied like everybody else. "What did you expect from a bunch of handkerchief heads?" she asked him. "What did you expect?"
"I guess I expect the unexpectable," he said, "because they don't look at things like the way I do."
Here he was, running for his life, and the two of them were arguing over what couldn't be undone. George didn't ask Inez what he should do. He didn't consult her as to where he should go or whether she would join him. He just told her he was going up to where his aunts were.
"I'm going to New York and get situated," he said. "And when I get situated, I'll send for you."
Their anniversary, April 19th, was coming up in a few days. But if everything worked according to plan, he would be gone by then. He felt there was no time for debating, and thought he should be the judge of what would happen to him. "After all," he would say years later, "it was my neck on the block." Inez heard the magic words, "I'll send for you," and did not put up much more of a fuss. He had not taken her to Detroit, but he would bring her to New York, and that was good enough for now. She warmed to the idea and felt better and better about it. She thought less now of the danger of the circumstances than of their new life up north. A chance to start over in a new place together. He told Mud and Sam he was leaving. They were leaving too. Sam was talking Washington, D.C., where he had a brother. Mud was talking about a place he had heard of called Rochester, New York. Then little George said goodbye to Inez and goodbye to his father, who, if he was worried, kept it to himself.
"Yeah, well," Big George said, "I think this will be the best. I guess if you're gonna still act that way, it's best for you to go."
Monroe, Louisiana, March 1953. Robert Joseph Pershing Foster. Pershing was working at Fort Polk, an hour's drive from Monroe, for the singular purpose of saving up the money to go to California. His heart was already gone. His mother had died. His widowed father, Professor Foster, had been forced out as principal of the school to which he had devoted his life by one of his own teachers. The coup left Professor Foster a leader in exile. He watched the new colored high school he had always dreamed of rise up under the name of his rival. Pershing grieved for his father, and all that had happened in a caste system that seemed to rely on pitting the lowliest people against one another. He drove between Monroe and Fort Polk at the edge of spring, blind to the wild grasses that blushed on either side of the Bayou Desert. The bayou cut through town and bent toward the west, and the land was thick with crimson clover crawling up the folds in the land. It was beautiful, but it didn't matter. Pershing was 34 years old. His life was in front of him, and he was not going to live it out in a one-stoplight town in the South. On that, he and Alice had agreed, and she would wait for him to send for her and the girls once he got situated. Still, his brother Madison tried to get him to stay, reclaim the family's former glory. Madison had a small practice there and was ready to etch Pershing's name beside his on the door. The two of them could work out of Madison's second-floor office on Desert. They could travel the parish in their portable hospital and tend to the colored school teachers and the women who took in washing, the athletes out at Grambling, and the sharecroppers who might pay with buttermilk or the side of a freshly killed hog. But Pershing did not want to be paid with buttermilk or the side of a freshly killed hog, and did not want to deliver babies in somebody's kitchen. There was a respectable hospital in town, St. Francis. It was a brick building that stood with the color and trim efficiency of a manila folder. It had white beds in one wing and colored beds in another, and was closed to colored doctors. Pershing put St. Francis out of his mind and figured he would work at Fort Polk until he had the money to leave. One day he went into town and walked into the old clothing shop of a white storekeeper. He had known the man since he was a little boy, picking up clothes for his father. "I'm M.J. Foster's boy. I think you have a suit for him," he used to go in and say. Pershing was grown up now. He was in uniform, with his captain's bars and medical caduceus. The storekeeper noticed and asked what he was going to do when he got out of the army.
"Well, I'm going to go into practice, private practice," Pershing said.
"Are you going to come here with your brother?"
"No, I'm going to California and start my practice there when I get out of Fort Polk. And this is what I plan to do." "What's wrong with St. Francis?"
Pershing shook his head. The man had lived there since before Pershing was born, and a central fact of colored people's existence hadn't registered after all these years.
"You know that colored surgeons can't operate at St. Francis, Mr. Masser."
The man looked startled and caught himself. White-only and colored-only signs were all over town, but the storekeeper had not thought about how segregation applied to the hospital. The storekeeper had watched Pershing grow into an upstanding young man, and had known the Fosters for years.
For a split second, the storekeeper seemed to see Pershing as no different than any other bright young physician. But Pershing's words brought him back to reality. The rest of the white world did not see Pershing the way the storekeeper did, and that gave the storekeeper an uncomfortable glimpse of the burdens on one of his best customers. There was a moment of awkwardness between the two men, and as the realization hit the storekeeper, the truth hit Pershing too. He stepped outside himself and considered the absurdity that he was doing surgery for the United States Army and couldn't operate in his own hometown. The man tried to recover, offer advice and encouragement.
"Well, why don't you all build a hospital, you and your brother?" "Mr. Masser, do you realize that we are doctors and not businessmen? The cost of building a hospital and operating one would be astronomical."
There was very little to say after that. Even the storekeeper could see the impossibility of the situation. He wished Pershing well in whatever he did, and Pershing went on his way. Mr. Masser had meant well. Still, it made no sense to Pershing that one set of people could be in a cage and the people outside couldn't see the bars. But he told himself it didn't matter anyway, because he was through with Monroe, through with small towns and small minds, and particularly small-minded small towns in the South. He didn't like how you couldn't get your teeth cleaned without everybody knowing it. He didn't like how the white people couldn't quite manage to call him Dr. Foster, but spat out Doc, as if they were addressing the cook. He didn't like how his brother Madison denied himself certain 20th-century conveniences to avoid submitting to the indignities of Jim Crow. Madison never went to the side window of a white restaurant, never sat in the back of the Paramount Theater like other colored people, because he never went. He drove his son, little Madison James, to the theater and watched the colored people climb the back stairs and pack the balcony to see whatever was playing. But he never went inside himself. In the 1940s, Madison had petitioned St. Francis Hospital for a position on staff. The hospital rejected him. But he refused to leave town, and he didn't let it stop him from working. If he couldn't practice at a hospital, he would carry a hospital in his trunk. He had a portable operating table built especially for his patients and lugged it into their shotgun houses when it was time to do surgery or deliver their babies. He didn't suffer the humiliation of seeing a suit he wanted to try on in a store, but couldn't because colored people weren't allowed that courtesy. He just never went. He sent his wife Harriet instead. The two of them would drive up and down Visard Street from Haynes to the Palace, the finest men's stores in town. Madison sat in the car and waited, while Harriet went from store to store and came out with an armload of clothes. She held up each suit on its hanger. He inspected the weave and the cut from the car window and told her which ones to buy. And that is how Madison got his wardrobe. Pershing wouldn't stand for that. Pershing wanted to walk right into the palace and try on a suit if he pleased, and sit in a corner booth at the lounge if he wanted. He was restless for a basic kind of freedom that was crazy at best, and arrogant at worst for a colored man in that place at that time, and the two brothers knew it. One last time, each made his pitch to the other. Pershing tried to get Madison to go with him to California, set up practice there. After all, they practically had a clientele waiting for them. Half of colored Monroe was already out there. Madison tried to get Pershing to stay. Louisiana was home, and things would never change if everyone gave up and left. What did Pershing know about starting a practice in California? He had never set foot in California. Running away meant Jim Crow had won, and Madison wasn't going to give the rascals that. And besides, there was no guarantee Jim Crow wasn't out in California.
It was getting to be early April. The brothers made a necessary peace. Pershing decided to leave the day after Easter with Madison's blessing, if not approval, and readied for the round of formal goodbyes. The Covingtons, who lived down the street from Madison, heard Pershing was leaving and planned the going-away party for the Saturday night before Easter. The Hills, the Browns, January the Taylor, and all the better-off colored people in Newtown gathered at the Covingtons' white-frame bungalow with the azaleas out front at the corner of 11th and Louise Ann Avenue. Ivory Covington cooked all day for the Fosters, fried chicken and waffles and collard greens and cornbread. The place was prim, with white tablecloths and upholstery, and smoky from the camels and Chesterfields. Pershing, the bon vivant in sport coat and ruler-creased trousers, made the rounds through the dining room and living room and Ivory's yellow kitchen, with a shot of bourbon in his hand. He was leaving first thing Monday morning, he told everyone, heading southwest to Houston on his way west to first stop by and see a Dr. Anthony Beale. You remember Anthony Beale, who used to go out with my sister Gold? He's practicing in Houston now, and he said he could help me get started there. But I said thank you very much, but I'm set on California. Late into the evening, Ivory's husband, N.E., turned down the record player in the front room, clearing the haze of chatter and bebop. The dancing by the credenza came to a stop. And Napoleon Brown and Pless Hill, Big Madison and Harriet, and the rest raised their glasses to Pershing, who was joining the migration without them. Pershing looked out into the faces and could not, for the life of him, figure out why these people were frittering away their lives in a place like this. "How in the world can you stay in Monroe?" he finally said, "and live in this Jim Crow situation?" It was pompous, as he was at times known to be, and perhaps out of place at so well-meaning a send-off. But he had convinced himself it was crazy to stay, and wrong if he left without coming right out and saying it. "How can you stay here and take the crumbs?" he said. "Come go to heaven with me, to California." He knew no more about California than they did, and he won no immediate converts that night. But he had planted the seed and would follow up once he had seen the state for himself. "I pick up my life and take it with me, and I put it down in Chicago, Detroit, Buffalo, Scranton. I pick up my life and take it on the train to Los Angeles, Bakersfield, Seattle, Oakland, Salt Lake, any place that is north and west and not south." Langston Hughes. One-way ticket. America, 1915 to 1975. As they summoned the will to leave, it would never have occurred to Ida Mae, George N. Pershing, or the millions of others who continued to flee the South over the decades of the Great Migration, that it was supposed to have ended in World War I when they were just coming into the world. They joined a flight already in progress when the narrow straits of their lives compelled them to do so. Theirs is a kind of living testimony that migrations fed by the human heart do not begin and end as neatly as statisticians might like. The Great Migration in particular was not a seasonal, contained, or singular event. It was a statistically measurable demographic phenomenon marked by unabated outflows of black emigres that lasted roughly from 1915 to 1975. It peaked during the war years, swept a good portion of all the black people alive in the United States at the time into a river that carried them to all points north and west. Like other mass migrations, it was not a haphazard unfurling of lost souls, but a calculable and fairly ordered resettlement of people along the most direct route to what they perceived as freedom, based on railroad and bus lines. The migration streams were so predictable that by the end of the migration, and to a lesser degree even now, one can tell where a black northerner's family was from just by the city the person grew up in. A good portion of blacks in Detroit, for instance, having roots in Tennessee, Alabama, western Georgia, or the Florida Panhandle, because the historic rail lines connected those places during the migration years. "Migratory currents flow along certain well-defined geographical channels," wrote E.G. Ravenstein, a British historian, in his landmark 1885 study of human migration. "They are like mighty rivers which flow along slowly at the outset, and after depositing most of the human beings whom they hold in suspension, sweep along more impetuously until they enter one of the great reservoirs." The Great Migration ran along three main tributaries and emptied into reservoirs all over the north and west. One stream, the one George Starling was about to embark upon, carried people from the coastal states of Florida, Georgia, the Carolinas, and Virginia up the eastern seaboard to Washington, Philadelphia, New York, Boston, and their satellites. A second current, Ida Mays, traced the central spine of the continent, paralleling the Father of Waters from Mississippi, Alabama, Tennessee, and Arkansas to the industrial cities of Cleveland, Detroit, Chicago, Milwaukee, Pittsburgh. A third and later stream carried people like Pershing from Louisiana and Texas to the entire West Coast, with some black Southerners traveling farther than many modern-day immigrants. The chronology of this great migration, as is the case in many immigrant experiences, was sometimes a more circuitous affair than might be expected, and has at times been reported. Some participants of the Great Migration made trips outside the South before their actual and final leaving, which suggests that a great deal of ambivalent churning preceded a fair number of departures. Many served overseas during wartime, in the First and Second World Wars, and in the conflict in Korea. Some managed to visit relatives up north. Some tried to make a go of it in one city before trying out another. These trips often exposed them to the freedoms they were denied back home, served as way stations where they could earn enough money for the next leg of their journey, or otherwise emboldened them and fed their desire to migrate. Thus, leaving the South was not always a direct path, but one of testing and checking of facts with those who have left ahead of them before making the great leap themselves. Yet the hardened and peculiar institution of Jim Crow made the Great Migration different from ordinary human migrations. In their desperation to escape what might be considered a man-made pestilence, Southern blacks challenged some scholarly assumptions about human migration. One theory has it that, due to human pragmatism and inertia, migrating people tend to go no further from their homes in search of work than is absolutely necessary, Ravenstein observed. "The bulk of migrants prefers a short journey to a long one," he wrote. "The more enterprising long-journey migrants are the exceptions and not the rule." Southern blacks were the exception. They traveled deep into far-flung regions of their own country, and in some cases clear across the continent. Thus, the Great Migration had more in common with the vast movements of refugees from famine, war, and genocide in other parts of the world, where oppressed people, whether fleeing 21st century Darfur or 19th century Ireland, go great distances, journey across rivers, deserts, and oceans, or as far as it takes to reach safety, with the hope that life will be better wherever they land. Part 3. Exodus. There is no mistaking what is going on. It is a regular exodus. It is without head, tail, or leadership. Its greatest factor is momentum, and this is increasing, despite amazing efforts on the part of white Southerners to stop it. People are leaving their homes and everything about them under cover of night, as though they were going on a day's journey, leaving forever. The Cleveland Advocate, April 28, 1917. We look up at the high southern sky. We scan the kind black faces we have looked upon since we first saw the light of day. And though pain is in our hearts, we are leaving. Richard Wright. 12 million black voices. The appointed time of their coming. Even the stork in the sky knows her appointed seasons, and the dove, the swift, and the thrush observe the time of their migration. Jeremiah, chapter 8, verse 7. Near Okolona, Mississippi, late autumn 1937, Ida Mae Brandon Gladney. Ida Mae and the children rumbled over curled ribbons of dirt road in a brother-in-law's truck from Miss Thiney's house to the train depot in Okolona. Piled high around them were all the worldly possessions they could manage to carry, the overalls and Sunday clothes, the cook pots and kerosene lamps, a Bible, and the quilts that Ida Mae and Miss Thiney had sewn out of used-up remnants of the clothes they had worn out tilling the Mississippi soil. Miss Thiney had not wanted them to go, and had prayed over them and with them, and then watched as her second-born daughter left the rutted land of the ancestors. "May the Lord be the first one in the car," Miss Thiney had whispered about the train they were hoping to catch, "and the last out." Heading to the depot through the dust hollows and the cotton fields, and away from the only place she had ever lived, Ida Mae did not know what would become of them, or if her husband could actually pull this thing off. She did not know if Mr. Ed would let them go, or stand in their way. If her husband would get anything from Mr. Ed at settlement, if they would be better off up north, or if they failed, worse off for having the nerve to try to leave. And if in the end, they would truly make it out of Mississippi at all. But there at the depot was her husband, the taciturn man who kept his emotions to himself, who had courted her and won her over despite Miss Thiney's objections, and who had decided that he did not want his family under the mercurial thumb of Mississippi for one more hour. He had not asked Ida Mae what she thought about leaving, or whether she wanted to go. He had merely announced his decision as the head of the family, as was his way, and Ida Mae had gone along with it, as was hers. She had not wanted to leave Miss Thiney and her sister Talma and all the people she had ever known, but her lot was with her husband, and she would go where he thought it best. Both she and Miss Thiney could take comfort in knowing that Ida Mae's sister Irene would be there to receive them in Milwaukee, and that half her husband's siblings were up north in Beloit, Wisconsin, and in Chicago, and so Ida Mae would not be alone in that new land. Mr. Ed had been a man of his word. He did not try to keep George and Ida Mae from leaving. George had gotten a few dollars from Mr. Ed and managed to secure 4 train tickets to Milwaukee via Chicago, having likely secured them not in Houston, where he might have been recognized, but in Okolona, where he was less likely to be noticed and where they would be leaving from. And so the family, Ida Mae, George, Velma, James, and the little one still forming in Ida Mae's belly, boarded a train in Okolona. They were packed in with the baggage in the Jim Crow car with the other colored passengers with their babies and boxes of fried chicken and boiled eggs and their belongings overflowing from paper bags in the overhead compartment. The train pulled out of the station at last, and Ida Mae was on her way out of Chickasaw County and out of the state of Mississippi for the first time in her life. Eustis, Florida, April 14th, 1945. George Swanson Starling. George had no time for formalities or the seeking of advice or reassurance. He had to go. There was no point in discussing it, and no one he told tried to argue him out of leaving, except for Inez, who wasn't so concerned that he was going, but that he wasn't taking her with him. He hadn't had time to figure out what to do with Inez. All he knew was he had to get himself out of Lake County, Florida, before the Grove owners got to him first. All three of the men who had stirred up the commotion in the groves were heading out quick. George to New York, Charlie to Rochester, Sam to Washington, D.C. They each had to figure out where they knew somebody up north, and the most direct route to wherever the people they knew were located. They did not so much choose the place, as the place presented itself as the most viable option in the time they had to think about it. They did not dare travel to the train station together, or allow themselves to be seen together once it was clear that they had to get out. George would be traveling, fast and light. A few books, some papers, a change of clothes. He got a man most people wouldn't associate him with, but whom he felt he could trust, old Roscoe Colton, to drive him to the train station at Wildwood, a good 45 minutes' drive on the 2-lane gravel roads from Eustis. They rode through the groves that George had picked, and that he knew the names of, and were the reason he was forced to leave. But he wasn't feeling sentimental about it. He had to get out of the county first. The two of them had to make sure they didn't attract attention to themselves, didn't get stopped along the way, and weren't being followed. They went west with the sun, rambling along the southern edge of Lake Eustis, passing the county seat of Tavares, where George and Inez had gotten married at the courthouse almost exactly 6 years before, and crossing into Sumter County, between Lake Deaton and Lake Okahumpka. Roscoe Colton's truck pulled up to the depot at Wildwood, and George, tight and sober-faced, walking slow and deliberate so as not to look like the fugitive he had unwittingly become, climbed the colored steps onto the silver meteor, headed for New York. Monroe, Louisiana, the Monday after Easter, 1953. Robert Joseph Pershing Foster. In the dark hours of the morning, Pershing Foster pulled away from his father and brother, the house on Louise Ann Avenue, and his caged existence in the caste-bound, isolated South. The night clouds crawled eastward, the sky itself floating in the opposite direction from him in the damp, cool air. He pointed his Buick Roadmaster to the west, away from Monroe, and settled into the tufted bench seat, for the nearly 2,000 miles of road ahead of him, the distance that now stood between him and California, between Jim Crow and freedom. He was setting out on a course that was well trodden by 1953. In the years before Pershing's migration, many hundreds of people from Monroe and thousands more from the rest of Louisiana had joined the river to California. Mantan Moreland, a minor Hollywood figure who made a name for himself as the fumbling manservant and loyal incompetent of black and white comedies and Charlie Chan capers, left Monroe for Los Angeles during the Depression. It spread around Newtown that he had been on his way to shining shoes in West Monroe and passed a tree with a colored man hanging from it. He left that day and headed to California. A toddler named Huey Newton was spirited from Monroe to Oakland with his sharecropper parents in 1943. His father had barely escaped a lynching in Louisiana for talking back to his white overseers. Huey Newton would become perhaps the most militant of the disillusioned offspring of the Great Migration. He founded the Black Panther Party in 1966, and reveled in discomfiting the white establishment with his black beret, rifle, and black power rhetoric. Another boy from Monroe, who migrated with his parents to Oakland, took an entirely different path. He would go on to become one of the greatest basketball players of all time. Bill Russell was born in Monroe in 1934, and watched his parents suffer one indignity after another. His father once went to a gas station only to be told he would have to wait for the white people to get their gas first. He waited and waited, and when his turn seemed never to come, he started to pull off. The owner came up, put a shotgun to his head, and told him he was not to leave until all the white people had been served. "Boy, don't you ever do what you just started to do,"
the station owner said. As for Russell's mother, a policeman once grabbed her on the street and ordered her to go and take off the suit